Well, the Food and Drug Administration today authorized the first COVID-19 vaccines for children under 5. The move would allow toddlers and infants as young as 6 months old to receive kid-sized doses of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. The FDA's commissioner said those shots will help save lives.
Any death of a child is tragic and should be prevented if possible. And COVID-19 is one of the leading causes of death in children. By vaccinating our youngest children, we hope to prevent the most devastating consequences of COVID, by extension, providing benefits to their families and communities.
The CDC is expected to make its final decision this weekend. If approved, child vaccinations could begin as early as next week. A third victim in last night's church shooting in a suburb of Birmingham, Alabama, has died. Police have now identified the suspect as a 71-year-old man who occasionally attended services at the Episcopal Church. He was taken into custody after he opened fire with a handgun during a potluck dinner. Authorities are still trying to piece together a motive. The Federal Reserve today doubled down on its pledge to curb soaring inflation, now at a 40-year high. In Washington, Fed Chair Jerome Powell said the central bank was, quote, acutely focused on returning inflation to our 2% objective. This week, it raised interest rates by 0.75%. Concerns over inflation fueled an especially volatile week on Wall Street. In the end, stocks were mixed today after posting their worst week since 2020. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 38 points to close at 29,889. The NASDAQ rose 152 points and the S&P 500 added 8. Officials in Brazil today confirmed that human remains found in the Amazon rainforest were those of British journalist Dom Phillips. A fisherman confessed to killing Phillips and his companion, indigenous expert Bruno Pereira. Police said they suspect that others were involved. Authorities have not yet identified Pereira's remains, and the investigation is still ongoing. Former Trump advisor Peter Navarro pleaded not guilty today to contempt of Congress. Navarro defied a subpoena from the House committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol and refused to provide testimony and documents. He will go on trial in mid-November. The British government today approved the extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the U.S. on spying charges. U.S. prosecutors want him to stand trial for releasing thousands of classified military and diplomatic records. His supporters say he's being politically targeted for exposing the U.S. military's wrongdoing in Afghanistan and Iraq. Assange's wife warned the decision could set a dangerous precedent for press freedom.
He has done everything that any self-respecting journalist should do when given evidence of a state committing crimes of corruption. They publish it because their duty is to the public. And Julian's duty to the public has landed him in prison for already more than 3 years.
Assange's lawyers are already planning to appeal. His legal battle could take months or even years to wrap up. Back in this country, the Golden State Warriors are celebrating their fourth NBA championship title in 8 years. Crowds of fans cheered their victory over the Boston Celtics last night, just 2 years after the Warriors had the league's worst record. We'll have more on their championship win later in the program. Still to come on the News Hour, Jonathan Capehart and Michael Gerson weigh in on the latest political headlines, how the Golden State Warriors have built a dynasty led by Steph Curry. Activist Virginia Rose gives her brief but spectacular take on increasing access to natural spaces, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
This week, more than 100 million Americans were under some sort of heat advisory and were warned to stay indoors if possible. From Texas to California, a massive heat wave has set record temperatures, raising concerns about how hot is too hot. William Brangham has our report.
Amna, Las Vegas, Phoenix, Denver, and St. Louis are among some of the cities that have reported record-setting temperatures this month. And more than 50 million Americans are expected to endure triple-digit temperatures in the days to come. And we know these heat waves can be deadly, like this time last year in the Pacific Northwest, where hundreds of people in the U.S. and Canada were estimated to have died from the heat. For more on how extreme temperatures impact the body, I'm joined by W. Larry Kenny. He's a professor of physiology and kinesiology at Penn State. Larry Kenny, great to have you on the NewsHour. I think most people have some sense of how they personally react when they go outside and they work outside on a really hot day. But can you give us a primer on what you know, what we know about what extreme heat does to the body?
Thank you for having me on. We've been studying the effects of heat stress and dehydration on human health and performance for a long period of time. And these recent heat waves that you've mentioned have really brought it into focus for a lot of people. Humans really are tropical animals, so we're pretty much geared up physiologically to withstand short periods of high temperatures and humidities. But it's the prolonged exposure to temperature and humidity that's really taken its toll. When we are exposed to prolonged high temperatures, there's an increase eventually in our body core temperature, which can, if left unchecked, affect many of the body's systems. But primarily, it also affects the cardiovascular system because the heart has to work increasingly hard to pump blood flow to the skin to try to dissipate the heat that we're building up. And we're doing that in the context of profuse sweating, which decreases our body fluids and blood volume.
So what are the sort of worst examples of the things that can happen? What are the sort of illnesses that can come from extreme heat?
The two most serious types of heat illness are heat exhaustion, which is primarily a function of high intensity exercise in a hot environment. And it's really a cardiovascular symptom, cardiovascular consequences that can be treated with moving to the shade, resting, getting body fluids. The more severe manifestation of heat illness is heat stroke. And heat stroke is exemplified by two criteria. One, an excessive rise in your body core temperature over 104 degrees Fahrenheit, and then some sort of cognitive impairment or neurological dysfunction, such as not knowing where you are, how you got there, losing consciousness, and so on. And heat stroke is a life-threatening situation that always needs to be treated with exigency.
And what we know that these people who are vulnerable to these kinds of complications, it's not spread equally over the population, right? Certain people are more vulnerable.
Absolutely. Our interest has been in the aging population. And in reference to your lead-in, we're doing a series of experiments now looking at that specific question you mentioned, which is how hot is too hot? How humid is too humid, where being over the age of 65 or 80 makes a difference. So even in healthy aging, we have increased vulnerability to heat stress. Then all of the comorbidities that come along with aging, like cardiovascular problems, diabetes, respiratory problems, some of the medications that are taking all add on to that toll. The other group that really has a disadvantage when it comes to heat stress are infants, who primarily are at the beck and call of parents to make sure they stay cool, stay well hydrated, and so on.
We know that climate change is making these heat waves more common, and the ones that then come are more intense. So human beings are going to have to be living in these extreme circumstances more and more often. You touched on this idea of how hot is too hot. When do we get to the point where human beings simply can't be living and working outside? What is that? Do we know?
I think we have a pretty good idea, especially in humid climates. There is an old adage among the meteorology community that will happen when the ambient temperature gets to about 95 degrees Fahrenheit and 100% humidity. But our research, especially some of our recent research, has shown that that occurs actually at lower temperatures, something more on the order of 88 degrees and 100% humidity, or 100 degrees and 60% humidity, even in healthy young men and women. So we have not approached that 95 degree 100% humidity extreme anywhere on Earth for at least prolonged periods, but we're getting very close to the one that we've uncovered.
And it seems like that's going to then change how we build our cities, how we air condition our homes. I mean, it seems like we're talking about major infrastructural changes if we're going to keep living in this warming world.
Absolutely. And a lot of the problems in addition to or on top of health-related problems come from disparities in socioeconomic status, access to air conditioning, being able to be looked in on by neighbors and taken to some place that does have air conditioning if necessary. So a lot of these problems are really coming to the head at the present time.
All right, Larry Kenney of Penn State University, thank you very much for being here.
You're very welcome.
The European Union's executive arm today recommended putting Ukraine and its smaller neighbor Moldova on paths to EU membership. This comes after the U.S. and Europe pledged earlier this week to further support Ukraine militarily and as the war grinds on. John Yang has the story.
In the southern port city of Mykolaiv, another residential building crushed by Russian shelling. After nearly 4 months of war, destruction and death seems endless. In the east, cities strewn with rubble. A Russian rocket hit this bomb shelter in Lysychansk, once a cultural center where 40 people took refuge. At least four of them were killed. Shell-shocked residents are hanging by a thread.
What is going to happen to us? We don't know ourselves what is going to be tomorrow. This war has to be finished.
The twin city of nearby Severodonetsk has been besieged for weeks. On Russian state TV, Moscow showed off its handiwork at the Azot chemical plant, where hundreds of civilians shelter underground. Severodonetsk remains the focus of fighting in eastern Ukraine, where Russian forces aim to capture the entire Donbas region. Ukrainian officials say hundreds of their soldiers are killed each day.
The president, not here.
But in Kyiv today, a show of support. In his second surprise visit, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson offered to train up to 10,000 Ukrainian soldiers every 120 days.
We're here once again to underline that we are with you to give you the strategic endurance that you will need.
And in Brussels, a morale boost for Ukraine. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said the bloc should consider Kyiv as a candidate for membership in the EU.
Ukraine has clearly demonstrated the country's aspiration and the country's determination to live up to European values and standards.
European leaders tried to present a united front this week as the French, German, Romanian, and Italian leaders visited President Zelensky for the first time since the war began. They toured Irpin, a town outside Kyiv, hammered by Russian forces, and brought with them a message of solidarity.
You can count on us. Ukraine can count on us. Europe, from the first day of this war, has clearly chosen its side, that of a free and sovereign Ukraine.
But EU leaders have been divided over what victory in Ukraine should look like, hinting at a ceasefire. Macron has even said Russian interests should be considered. Kyiv has criticized the bloc for a perceived lack of unconditional support. Still, Zelensky urged them to stay united.
Russian aggression against Ukraine is aggression against all of Europe. Our response must be united.
NATO defense ministers also met in Brussels this week, pledging to send Ukraine more weapons and boost its forces in Europe's eastern flank. At the annual International Economic Forum in St. Petersburg, Russian President Vladimir Putin hit out at the West.
They think the domination of the West in global politics and economics is constant and eternal, but nothing is eternal.
But for these Ukrainian soldiers defending their country's eastern front line with everything they've got, Ukrainian nationalism is eternal.
We are a strong nation. We will prevail. Victory is ours.
For more on these developments in Russia's four-month-long invasion of Ukraine, we're joined by Jeremy Shapiro, research director for the European Council on Foreign Relations. He was on the State Department's policy planning staff during the Obama administration. Mr. Shapiro, thanks so much for joining us. What's the significance, the European Union beginning the process of EU membership for Ukraine? What's the significance of that?
At the moment, the significance is mostly symbolic. It shows a great deal of solidarity with Ukraine, and it's a message that the Europeans are sending to both Russia and Ukraine, that they are with Ukraine and that they are going to do their utmost to support them. But it's a long-term process, and it probably won't make any immediate difference on the battlefield in any way.
You talk about European solidarity with Ukraine. There's been some question about that, about whether some European nations wouldn't prefer a quick settlement of this war, even if it meant Ukraine giving up some territory to Russia. Did this visit with the leaders of France, Germany, and Italy dispel any of that?
I'm not sure I'd go so far as that it dispelled that, but certainly there was no hint of that in the visit. In no way, shape, or form did they signal that they were pressuring the Ukrainians in any way to settle this war, which is a little bit, as you point out, at variance with some of the hints that President Macron of France and Chancellor Scholz of Germany have given in the past.
The headlines coming out of Ukraine every day are about fighting, Russian bombardment, buildings being destroyed, lives being destroyed. Are there negotiations going on, and is it possible that that could lead anywhere?
There is some level of negotiation going on. As I understand it, there is some contact between the Ukrainian and Russian side, but I wouldn't say that there's any real negotiations going on. There was some effort at that in March, but really nothing has progressed since then. I think that the sort of scale of the Russian atrocities that has been demonstrated since then have made it very difficult for the Ukrainians or anyone else to negotiate with the Russians. And so there's really very little happening, and there's massive disagreements in any case on what that settlement would look like. But at the same time, I think we need to understand that nobody knows how to get out of this war except through a negotiated settlement.
Should there be a limit to the United States support for Ukraine in this?
President Biden likes to say that the support is unlimited, but that doesn't really make a lot of sense. Obviously, the United States is not the same as Ukraine. And even if the United States is clearly in Ukraine's camp, it's not going to be willing to expend all of its efforts for Ukraine. Their interests are not distinct. And I think that the United States has had a lot of trouble sort of signaling to the Ukrainians that while their support is real, while their support is meaningful, if given, after all, well over $50 billion in assistance at this point, or at least promised that, that their support is not unlimited, and that the Ukrainians also need to be thinking about how to get out of this war. But that is not a message, I think, that has come across as yet.
If the Biden administration were to suggest to the Ukrainians that there should be a negotiated settlement, what would be the contours of that? What would be the goals that the United States would urge Ukraine to, I don't want to say settle for, but would be acceptable?
Well, the United States has outlined that the goal of the war is to protect Ukrainian sovereignty and territorial integrity. They have further pointed out that they are not going to force the Ukrainians into any settlement. And I think that they mean that. But as I said, the degree of U.S. assistance gives them the right to express an opinion on what the contours of that settlement might be. And I think what they would want to be thinking about is, first of all, a status for Ukraine. The Ukrainians floated a neutrality status to the Russians in March. They would also want to be thinking about security guarantees that could be provided to the Ukrainians by the United States, by other Western allies, and perhaps by Russia, in order to guarantee that neutrality and to guarantee Ukrainian territorial integrity. And then in the most difficult area of all, I think that they would want to be thinking about how to resolve the territories that are being occupied by Russia. There is absolutely no agreement on that front at all. And I think it's very difficult to understand even what the U.S. could ask of the Ukrainians. It would be quite difficult to ask them to give up territory that is that rightfully belongs to Ukraine. But one could at least imagine a formula that, while not in any way giving up Ukrainian claims, at least puts those territories to the side and allows them to have some sort of ceasefire where they can then negotiate the final status of those territories. It's important to emphasize that we're very far from that right now. And the U.S. is not asking the Ukrainians to do that, and may never do so. But ultimately, if we want to solve the war through a negotiation, we are going to have to at least start to look at those issues, even though many people think that it is wrong to even talk about them.
Jeremy Shapiro, the European Council on Foreign Relations, thank you very much.
Thank you.
More than 7 million people have fled Ukraine since the fighting broke out in February. Among them, nearly 80,000 foreign students, most from developing nations. Although Ukraine is better known as one of the world's top agricultural producers, it's also become a hub for higher education. Indian nationals account for almost a quarter of all foreign students enrolled in Ukraine, most of them studying medicine. As Fred DeSam Lazaro reports from New Delhi, they now face an uncertain future.
It's a special Friday lunch, a traditional Punjabi meal being prepared for a family get-together. But the Giridhar family's only daughter, Karima, helping mom in the kitchen, shouldn't really be here. Relieved though her folks are that she is. Just over 3 months ago, she was sending home images from Ukraine, where she was in the middle of her third year of medical school, being assured by authorities that there would be no conflict, she says, until just hours before it actually began.
Every 2 or 3 hours there are being sirens, and we have to run to the bunkers.
In the bunkers, they plan their escape.
We were all afraid about everything. I contacted with my agent, and he booked a bus to Romania. And the bus dropped us 20 kilometers before the borders.
They walked 12 and a half miles in frigid temperatures to the Romanian border. But unlike thousands of fleeing Ukrainians, she says, the Indian students were not allowed to pass.
They said, we will not let you cross. We will allow first our local citizen to cross, and then we will let you cross. We have to wait there for like one night, and we were on the roads lighting a fire so we can get some warmth to us.
Indian government or Indian embassy.
A group returned hours later, desperate to try their luck again.
We are, you know, like pushing. I just crossed the border, and when I turned, nobody was there with me.
It was several days before she was able to join thousands of other Indian students returning home in an evacuation organized by India's government.
I wasn't able to breathe properly until she came back.
For Garima's mother, Ritu Bala, that relief has gradually given way to worry that 3 years of medical education they could barely afford could now be wasted.
It's always been her dream. It's been difficult, but we took out bank loans to send her to study. We are worried what will happen in the future.
In India, it's extremely competitive to get into public medical universities and prohibitively expensive in private ones. The cost of a medical education in Ukraine can be as little as one-third of what it costs here in India.
Since her unexpected return, Garima has continued to hang on to a semblance of normalcy, as has her school, the Ternopil Medical University, with online instruction.
And what more we can give?
Dr. Oksana Drapak is one of Garima's professors in pharmacology.
Thanks for making the time.
I spoke briefly to her over a shaky video connection.
Where I live now is the most calm part of Ukraine. But when we hear the signal of air alarm, yes, we should go to the safe place. Usually it's somewhere on the underground.
One benefit of the pandemic is it familiarized teachers and students with working online, she says. Today, amid the war's horrors, Dr. Drapak says it's been a lifeline.
It takes me out from these horrible scenes I see and hear everywhere, and helps me to keep normal way of life, yes, for some period.
It keeps you from going crazy just all the time, focusing
yes.
on
it keeps me from
you.
Going crazy, yes.
Garima Giridhar is grateful to attend online, something not available from all Ukrainian medical schools, but she worries about missing a critical component of her medical education, clinicals.
When we were practicing in person, we are able to see the patients, we are able to do the clinical practice, but now we cannot do so.
She hopes that gap could be filled in India.
And how many people belong to this group?
Garima is among 6,000 students in a group pulled together on the social messaging app Telegram by Pulkit Parikh, a fourth-year student at Bogomilets National Medical University in Kyiv.
We are approaching the central government. So
they've been lobbying government officials at federal and state levels to allow them to transfer into Indian med schools.
The main thing is that because now it's have been long time and we don't know when the war will stop.
Different type of lobes are there.
India's Supreme Court has ordered the country's National Medical Council to develop plans to accommodate students forced to return from abroad, especially in finding clinical placement. It's a heavy lift. Curriculums are structured differently, and there's the sheer number and space. India's 542 medical schools are at their enrollment limit.
For every 17 students who appeared for the national entrance examination, there was only one medical seat.
Dr. Srinath Reddy of the Public Health Foundation of India hopes the plight of the Ukraine returnees forces this country to sharply increase the number of doctors it produces.
In OECD countries, it is 44 per 100,000. Medical graduates graduating.
This is in generally rich countries.
Rich countries. Whereas in India, it's 9 per 100,000.
And it's sort of ironic, is it not, that India is such a major exporter of medical doctors?
Unfortunately, that's true.
One 2017 study showed that 69,000 Indian medical school graduates now practice medicine in the US, Canada, the UK, and Australia. Pursuing superior facilities and pay compared to what's available in India when they graduate.
Next point, get housemate.
The question for students like Garima today is graduate from where and when?
We are going back in September, according to them.
And according to you?
I don't know. For security or maybe other reasons, I don't think it is possible right now to go back.
For her part, pharmacology professor Drapak reflects a resolve heard frequently from Ukraine's leaders.
I have a great belief in our army, which will overcome these problems, yes, and students may come back. And I hope, yes, and in September we will see each other.
Garima Girdar is due back in September for a critical final exam in Ukraine, which must be taken in person. One that determines if she'll move on to the fourth of her six-year course. For the PBS NewsHour, this is Fred DeSamlazaro in New Delhi.
And a quick note that Fred's reporting is in partnership with the Undertold Stories Project at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. As new revelations are reverberating across the political landscape after the third public hearing on the January 6th Capitol attack. Meanwhile, a framework for new gun regulations is beginning to splinter as senators try to turn their broad agreement into a detailed plan. That brings us to the analysis of Capehart and Gerson. That is Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post, and his colleague at The Post, opinion columnist Michael Gerson. David Brooks is away. Welcome to you both. Nice to see you.
Thank you.
Great to see you.
So let's start with those talks in the Senate. A bipartisan group of senators we know have been close. They say they have a framework when it comes to gun violence prevention. Those are led by Chris Murphy of Connecticut, of course, John Cornyn of Texas. But just yesterday, John Cornyn walked out of those talks saying this as he walked out. He said, it's fish or cut bait. I don't know what they, meaning Democrats, have in mind, but I'm through talking. So, Jonathan, could the talks fall apart once again?
Yes, they can. How many weeks have I sat here on Friday saying, I'm happy they're talking, it's great that they're talking, but I'll believe it when I see it when we go from talks to press conference to passage of the bill to signing. The fact that Senator Cornyn has walked away from the table is the least surprising thing. The announcement of the framework on Sunday was really hopeful. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there were a lot of things on there that Democrats thought, wow, we didn't think that we could get this as part of the framework. But the fact that Senator Cornyn is saying he's done talking and it's time to fish or cut bait, well, what's the issue? I mean, does he have a problem with the boyfriend loophole, which is what a lot of the reporting is? Well, mm-hmm. What's your proposal? We have to keep in mind that it's not like Democrats haven't compromised. If Democrats put forth all the stuff they wanted, an assault weapons ban would be in it. So many other things would be in the framework. But Democrats have made it clear, we need to do something. The fact that Senator Cornyn is walking away from the table, it quite sadly, more of the same.
So, Michael, Jonathan's right. The reporting is that it's this boyfriend, closing the boyfriend loophole, the keeping guns away from abusive partners. That's the sticking point for Republicans and John Cornyn. There's a lot of stuff in here. There's funding for school safety and mental health, background checks for states to pass and bolster red flag laws. So what does Cornyn walking away do?
Well, I agree with Jonathan. This is an incremental bill. That's the way it was designed. Mm-hmm. And in fact, what's in there, my fear is that it would not do enough to kind of address these issues, and then you would still have some difficult problems. But it does matter that Mitch McConnell has at least provisionally endorsed an approach like this. Mm-hmm. And that gives kind of permission to a group of senators, I think, who are in more purple states and some of them running for re-election, that they may want to have something to say about a problem, a huge moral problem. We need to remember the context here, which is the murder of children. Right. I think that Cornyn looks bad because he's ignoring essentially the moral imperatives of our moment.
But Cornyn also got booed, we should say. Today he was speaking at a Republican convention in Texas. He brought this up, that this deal's in the works, and he got booed. What does that tell you?
Well, this was a pretty hardcore audience, I assume, of Texas Republicans. But it's, there is some risk in any deal. My concern, though, is that we were moving towards a deal on criminal justice reform, for example, and it fell apart. And I'm afraid, that may happen in this case, although I think there are some, not yet.
All right. Well, I want to move on to the January 6th committee hearings, of course, because that was another big week with two more hearings, public hearings on the books. They now have three hearings behind them, three more, we believe, to go. Each of you actually shared with us moments that stood out to you. There was a lot of information in those hearings. I want to play for you those moments and get you to react. Jonathan, you remembered this moment from former federal appellate judge Michael Luttig. He'd been advising Vice President Mike Pence that Pence couldn't do what Trump wanted him to do, which was throw out the election results. Here's just part of what Luttig said.
I would have laid my body across the road before I would have let the vice president overturn the 2020 election on the basis of that historical precedent.
That is Judge Michael Luttig. I apologize, I mispronounced his name. Why did that moment stand out to you?
Judge Luttig is a giant. He is a giant among conservative lawyers. His reputation is, I'm trying to think of the liberal equivalent. You don't get more senior and more revered than that. The fact that he said he would have thrown himself in Vice President Pence's way to stop him from doing that was pretty incredible. But the other thing he says that we did not show was that he had a warning that Donald Trump and the folks who follow him present a, quote, clear and present danger to our American democracy. This is no liberal Democrat who's talking. This is no just, you know, rank and file Democrat talking. This is a tried and true, dyed in the wool conservative jurist who is saying, ringing the alarm about this scheme that Eastman had come up with, that they were trying to get Vice President Pence to go along with, and who is also saying, they're not done. This scheme is not done. January 6th, he didn't say this part, but I'm saying this part. January 6th is a rehearsal for what we could see in 2024.
Michael, I found it interesting. Most of the folks who testified, most of the people we heard from were Republicans. And you recall this one moment that stood out to you where we heard from chief counsel to the vice president, Greg Jaca. We learned a lot about what Mike Pence was doing on January 6th, how he was down in a secure location, continuing to work, even as rioters outside were chanting, "Hang Mike Pence." Here is a moment in which Greg Jaca was talking about what happened then.
Does it surprise you to see how close the mob was to the evacuation route that you took? The 40 feet is the distance from me to you, roughly.
I could hear the din of the rioters in the building while we moved, but I don't think I was aware that they were as close as that.
Make no mistake about the fact that the vice president's life was in danger.
Why did that moment stick with you?
Because it's something we shouldn't get used to. I mean, we had a moment where, with a mob intent on harm, fed and pushed by the sitting president of the United States against his most loyal lieutenant. And it was a near-run thing. This could have been the murder of the vice president. I mean, how would American politics have responded to such a thing? Mm-hmm. And, you know, one thing that came out in the hearing is that during this, as it was happening, President Trump was tweeting pressure tweets attacking the vice president for lacking courage as this was happening. And that indicates to me, you know, a reckless regard for not just his political future, but his life. You know, this is a president, I think we learned again, but it's the most dramatic example. This is not just a corrupt politician. This is an evil man, an amoral man. And that, I think, is, you know, important as we come around to the next election where, you know, he's the Republican frontrunner. That is a dire situation for the Republic.
Jonathan, there was another moment that stood out to me when we heard from communications between Trump's lawyer, John Eastman, sending messages. He's the one who's recommending sort of a plan for how to do this to overturn the election results. And the committee basically shared that he emailed saying, "I've decided I should be on the pardoned list if that is still in the works." What was your reaction when you heard that?
Well, I mean, my mouth was agape. You only ask for a pardon if you know or feel that you've done something wrong. I would never ask for a pardon. Right? Why? What have I done? What have I done? But Eastman knew. He knew. The committee showed that he knew from the beginning that what he was proposing was... this is public television. I almost went there. Was not right. was not right. And so he pushed it. And then after January 6th, he sees what happened and then says, "I want to give me a pardon."
We still have three more hearings to go, I should say. And there's already been so much evidence laid out by the committee. But Michael, do you see a world in which they end the hearings, they wrap all this up, and there's no action from the Department of Justice? Is that a possibility?
It's a definite possibility, although the Department of Justice made some noise this week, mm-hmm. essentially saying, "We'd like those transcripts, the ones that you have of these witnesses." Because there is a parallel investigation going on with the committee and the Justice Department, and they've started stepping on one another's feet a little bit. But that does show that the DOJ is looking closely mm-hmm. at what's happening in these hearings, which I regard as a good sign. There's going to be tremendous pressure on Garland to do this, but I think it's going to be a very tough choice for them because it would set a precedent of pursuing criminal charges against former presidents that we've never really had before. We'll see.
Do you also think Mike Pence should testify? We haven't heard from him.
I would have loved to heard him. Yeah. About all this, and you know, but he has tried to, you know, get as far away from his own actions as he possibly could, because he still sees a path to the presidency that doesn't exist.
We will see. Three more hearings, as I say, to go. Before we let you go, Jonathan, I do want to get your thoughts on this, because ahead this weekend, Sunday is Juneteenth.
Right.
It is just the second time in our country's history we are marking this day as a federal holiday. And I just wanted to ask, and as the country notes this day, as we mark it together, how are you reflecting on what it means this year?
Well, I'm reflecting on the fact that there are school districts and states that would make it difficult to even teach what Juneteenth is about, simply because, you know, some parents offended that the word slavery is used, that people were enslaved and worked for free and were tortured and all sorts of other things in the creation and the building of this country. You know, we just saw in Buffalo, African Americans targeted by someone who is a believer in the Great Replacement conspiracy. Juneteenth gives us an opportunity to talk about this nation's foundational wound that we still refuse to talk about, that we still refuse to confront. And so, you know, we're in a moment in this country where Juneteenth, if a lot of these folks get their way, very well just might be a marker on the calendar with no explanation about what it means and why it's important that we commemorate that holiday.
Let's hope we don't waste that opportunity. Thank you for that. Jonathan Capehart, Michael Gerson. Thank you so much for being here. Good to see
Thanks,
you.
Honey.
Well, after a two-year absence from the playoffs, the Golden State Warriors are back on top of the NBA. And the Warriors, often referred to as the Dubs, are staking a new claim on the reach and influence of their dynasty. They were led once again by Steph Curry, widely considered the best pure shooter the league has ever seen. There's also a lot of talk about Curry, his teammates, and where the Warriors belong in the pantheon of basketball history by changing the game. We're going to dive into all of this with NBA writer Michael Lee. He's long covered the league for The Washington Post, and he joins us now. Michael Lee, welcome to the NewsHour. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So this team, this core trio in particular on the Warriors, right? Steph Curry, Draymond Green, and Klay Thompson, they have won together before, their first championship back in 2015, a couple more after that. But going into this season, there were a lot of doubters about whether they could pull it off again. Why was there so much doubt, and how did they do it?
Well, I mean, they missed the playoffs. I mean, just 2 years ago, they had the worst record in the NBA. And there are a lot of people wondering if they could ever bounce back. Klay Thompson, you know, had an ACL injury and an Achilles injury, which most people can never recover from. Draymond Green, like he was on the downside of his career. Steph Curry was still putting up big numbers, but they weren't impacting winning. So it was easy to doubt that this team was going to come back and become a championship contender. But they made so many sneaky moves, you know, in those last 2 years, trading for Andrew Wiggins, drafting Jordan Poole, and just accumulating so much young talent that they could really keep this dynasty going a lot longer than everybody anticipated. And they just had a lot of faith. They had a lot of confidence that they had a foundational player in Stephen Curry who could deliver when it counted, and that the other guys would be able to step up and have the type of performances that could help them lead to another championship.
You use that key D word, that word dynasty. We've heard so much,
yeah.
Right? And there's a comparison to dynasties of the past. You look at the 60s Celtics and the 90s Bulls, and even Curry, Steph Curry last night after they won, acknowledged the pressure that comes with that. You know, said, I don't know how many other teams could have these kinds of records with comparison to these past dynasties and still come out on top of the mountaintop, as he put it. So they now have four titles in eight seasons. Is it fair to call them a dynasty? Is that what they've built?
Absolutely. I mean, and they were dominant, especially during that period where they had Kevin Durant. But this, you know, you always hear that you'll never see another team like this built, and you won't. Because a lot of times when you have a dynasty, you have a number one pick or a top three pick that just turns into a Michael Jordan or a Bill Russell or a Magic Johnson. You know, you have these foundational players who you know the moment you pick them that you're going to win a couple titles with these guys. With the Warriors, No one knew Steph Curry was going to be the foundation for a franchise team. Klay Thompson was the 11th pick. Draymond Green was the 35th pick. So when you're picking homegrown talent, they're actually picking in the back end of the lottery. So the guys who they selected were not expected to be foundational pieces. And then Steph Curry's slow pace to become a superstar in this league. He didn't become an MVP until his sixth season, but he wasn't an all-star until his fourth. So there are a lot of doubts about him because he had injuries with his ankles. And he signed one of the best deals in the history of NBA, a four-year, $44 million deal that really allowed this dynasty to take place because they had the cap space to sign Andre Iguodala. And then they had a huge cap boon that opened up the space for them to sign Kevin Durant. It was unprecedented. It never happened. And they were able to go forward and build a dynasty with that. And everybody thought it was over when Kevin Durant left. But again, Steph Curry, he's somebody that is a unique player that we've never seen in this league, a 6'3 guard who can dominate the game. We usually get that kind of dominance from a center. But with the three-point shot and the way he revolutionized the game and led this entire movement, this is his moment, and he's taking advantage of it.
Michael, the dynasties of the past were playing at a different time. The game was played very differently in the league right now. And you look at the way the game has changed, there's so much more reliance on three-point shots where Steph is a master. So is it true? Has he changed the game? And is he the best shooter that we've seen?
There's no question about that. But I think that, you know, limiting him to just a shooter kind of diminishes all that he brings to the table. He has an impeccable handle. He can dribble better than anybody out there. He can finish at the rim, and he doesn't get tired. You know, the one thing about being a great shooter is, like, what can you do beyond that? Well, he can create space for everybody on the floor. And just there's a fear that comes from where whenever he crosses half court, they know that that's his range. And when you have that kind of ability, once you cross half court, then you draw the defense right to you. And guys can just be themselves and, you know, play at a high level just because of your presence. And that's really what Steph's brought to the game. I think, you know, a lot of times say he's the greatest shooter we've ever seen. And yes, he is the all-time three-point shooter. But he's a great shooter. He's a great passer. He's a great dribbler. And he's a great teammate. You know, not many guys are going to be willing to step aside for another superstar to come in and flourish. Not many guys are going to look at young players like a Jordan Poole or Andrew Wiggins and say, you know what, I have faith in you. I think we can trust you to come through in big moments. And Steph has done that. His spirit has really lifted this Warriors franchise in a way that I can only find, like, maybe Magic Johnson or Tim Duncan with the Spurs. You know, previous, you know, multiple time champions. And I don't know if they're done. You know, the weird thing about this title is that I think they kind of are a little bit ahead of the curve. You know, they have a stockpile of young talent that's just sort of waiting for a chance to break through. So they can keep this thing going for a little while longer. That's the scary thing about what's happening is that this could be the beginning of another run for this group.
All right, we're going to hold you to that prediction. We'll have you back to see if it proves true. In the meantime, they are a lot of fun to watch. That is Michael Lee. He covers the NBA for the Washington Post. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Virginia Rose, who has been using a manual wheelchair for more than 40 years, knows how difficult it can be to enjoy nature as a disabled person. With her organization, Birdability, Rose finds ways to increase access to nature for people of all abilities and to help others find community. Tonight, she offers her brief but spectacular take on finding independence while birdwatching.
When I started birding and there were disabled people on the trails, I loved watching their faces make this look like this when they saw a bird through binoculars or through a scope for the first time. This, and then Carolina wren, purple martins, lawnmower. In 1973, I was 14 years old. I was riding my horse in a rural nearby homestead. He spooked. I fell and was paralyzed in that accident. And I've been in a manual wheelchair ever since. In so many ways, I was exactly the same person. I was still fairly gregarious, still fairly interested and curious in the world around me and people. And so the only thing that I felt really changed was that I had to manage getting around in a wheelchair. I think part of the beauty of nature is this very experience of stopping and listening and giving yourself the time to be there, find the bird, identify it. I think each of us has had an experience in nature when we've been alone. We're not entertaining anybody, nor are we being entertained. I think it's a very important experience, especially for people who have disabilities. I always say that when I'm alone in nature, I show up because there isn't anyone else there. BirdAbility is an organization that seeks to help people who have access challenges be outside in nature. When I was introducing disabled people to birding, I focused on the things that would keep them from coming. And of course it's going to be parking, and of course it's going to be restrooms. I can't tell you how many disabled people, when they saw me as the leader of this event, were so relieved. I first started birding and I was the only person in a wheelchair. That was not unusual to me at all. I feel like my entire life I've been the only person in a wheelchair. Hear that? Warblers off to the right, chimney swifts above us. I think one of the most important areas for people who have disabilities to explore is this idea of independence. You yourself are figuring out your environment. How do I get off the trail? How do I get back on the trail without help? And even if it's the littlest accomplishment, you come home more empowered than you were when you left. My name is Virginia Rose, and this is my brief but spectacular take on finding independence in birding. That was a scissor-tailed flycatcher.
And you can watch more of our brief but spectacular videos online. That's at pbs.org/newshour/brief. For more analysis of the week's January 6th committee hearings and the Federal Reserve's interest rate hike, don't forget to join moderator Yamiche Alcindor and her Washington Week panel that is tonight on PBS. And join us again here tomorrow evening for PBS News Weekend when Jeff Bennett sits down with singer Bonnie Raitt to discuss her new album and her enduring career.
I can't imagine the patience and the persistence that is required to navigate 50 plus years in this business. What have you learned about yourself along the way?
I've learned that I really love doing this and I will make whatever sacrifice I need to make sure that my voice is at its peak, my health is good, I keep my band and crew and salaries and my causes supported, and I have a bigger cause than just, you know, having a blast out on stage.
That is tomorrow on PBS News Weekend. I know I'll be watching. Meantime, that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz. For all of us here at the PBS NewsHour, thank you for joining us. Please stay safe and have a great weekend.